School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. These students are with us with the Court with Class program that's sponsored by the Supreme Court and the Wisconsin State Bar Association. Students from across the state are invited to participate in oral argument with us. And if they accept the invitation, they have gotten your briefs, and the class may have done some additional work on this case. They then come here, listen to oral argument, and meet with a justice after this oral argument, and they will be joined by students who are here for the first oral argument. The discussion at noon will involve the processes that the court uses to hear and decide cases, but not the substance of the matter. Everyone is welcome to join the students and listen to and participate in the discussion. If you do not have a familiarity with the case, I urge you to get a synopsis of the case, and they're available in the foyer. If you raise your hand, the marshal will bring you our synopsis of the case, which you may read. We're delighted to have met you, and I'd like to introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right is an empty chair, and Justice Patience Rogensack usually sits there. She will not be participating in this case. With those introductions made, I will now call this second case today, 03-0784, Charles Johnson et al. Versus Rogers Memorial Hospital. And the lineup for the presentations is 25 minutes to William Smoller, 10 minutes to Lori J. McElroy, 10 minutes to Sarah Zylstra, and 10 minutes to David McFarlane. And then, Mr. Smoller, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Correct? Okay, Mr. Smoller, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm attorney Bill Smoller, and I have the honor and privilege of representing Dr. and Mrs. Johnson, who are here today seated in the front row. In my law school experience and in practicing law, I've come to learn that the beauty of the law is that it is fluid and is able to adapt to social change, and that this court and other courts have the opportunity to apply public policy to events that are going on. While older concepts in the law are certainly revered, they are able to be applied and modified to adapt to new events, the computer age obviously being an example of this. One of the social experiences that happened in the 1980s and early 1990s was a therapy that became known as recovered memory therapy. The thesis of that therapy was that you could effect personal change or help yourself feel better, whether it's malaise or anxiety or real depression, by looking to past events that are supposedly repressed and revisiting them and then somehow dealing with them. Hopefully, your life will get better. The elements of recovered memory therapy, while not a recognized therapy, were the concept of repression, which was never substantially or established scientifically, but also that therapy led almost inevitably to accusations of childhood sexual abuse, usually against family members. Further elements of that, or things common to that, were that parents were called to confrontations where usually their daughters confronted them saying, we believe you sexually abused us when we were children. Lawsuits were brought against parents. Frequently, individuals, victims of that therapy, changed their names, as what happened in this case and in the Sawyer case. And almost inevitably, the patients became sicker, became hospitalized, and went through some significant emotional and mental health problems. This was a therapy advanced in the popular press and not scientifically validated. On the opposite side of the patient were people like Dr. and Mrs. Johnson, who were suddenly confronted with a horrible memory, where they were accused of abuse in a rather Kafkaesque experience. They weren't given the opportunity to say, wait, this didn't happen, or where is this coming from? They were simply told, by the way, I now know that when I was 2 or 3 years old, you sexually abused me. And the mantra of believe the victim was enough to validate that kind of accusation. If this were the state, we'd be talking about due process. But we aren't. We're talking about a therapy situation where a doctor or psychologist who a patient goes to and who the patient trusts instead leads the patient in this direction, which usually causes a complete deterioration of the family and the kind of confrontations and kind of experiences that this court knows from the Sawyer case and now knows from the Johnson case.
Mr. Smoller, if I might interrupt.
Yes.
You've made in your brief several arguments as to why we should not apply the therapist-patient privilege in this particular situation. Which do you feel is your strongest argument?
I think what this is a public policy question. This is a public policy question where we have to weight the damage that is done and giving a victim a right to a remedy versus the question of privilege and the way in which the weight that this court wants to give to that. If I were to weigh those things, and this I believe is the strongest argument, I think this court ought to decide this on a public policy basis, but if I were to try to identify why it should weight in favor of the patient, of the accused parent, it would be that this state recognizes a right to a remedy, that the state normally recognizes that people have a right to everyone's evidence, and because of the kind of language that this court has already endorsed in the Sawyer case, language that says things like society's justifiable repugnance towards sexual abuse of a child is the reason a falsely accused parent can be gravely harmed. There's more language in this court's decision in Sawyer and in other courts' decisions throughout the country. The damage here is so significant. And then I compare that to what is the loss here if the court says in this singular instance the confidentiality and privilege ought to be waived. And when I look at that loss, I come up with the following. First of all, the studies which I cited to you in the law review articles indicate that therapy is not damaged and is not affected by a Tarasoff kind of exception. Privilege does not inhibit therapy. So the loss as to privilege is not terribly significant in this case. Second, we already know, and this state has already endorsed the fact, that there are a variety of reasons why privilege is not absolute. First, there are exceptions in the statute. Second, this court has endorsed in Schuster the exception, saying that when somebody is potentially grievously harmed, we can allow for privilege to go. And then finally, what I think is the strongest argument, some of which I wish to amend, frankly, is this court does not have to go very far to allow for a case like this, does not have to go very far into the privilege question.
Okay, so what are the parameters that, you know, that you've reached that? Because I remember the Sawyer case and the public policy which was stated by the legislature as far as the confidentiality. Here we're talking about, you're saying recovered memory therapy, although the other side seems to say, well, no, we don't use that. So just say that a person goes to a psychiatrist or psychologist and states that 30 years ago this happened. There isn't any is that the type of case, or are you only talking about recovered memory therapy?
The problem is that recovered memory therapy is a popular press concept. Okay, it isn't a scientifically recognized.
What does that mean? I mean,
it means
if I'm a patient and I go to a psychiatrist with a deep dark secret and I want to discuss that, and I have every indication that what I say would be confidential. How do we distinguish between that case and the recovered memory therapy? In other words, is it simply an allegation that they used recovered memory therapy?
No. The allegation is one of negligence. The negligence here is simply that the therapy that was used, we believe, falls under this label of recovered memory therapy, but more importantly, falls under the category of negligence.
Doesn't that really open it up then?
No, and that's why, and I think I appreciate the question because I'd like to be able to answer that. The court would note that in my brief, I did provide what I believe is the solution in this situation, a proposed solution. And again, I want to modify that just a little bit. But first of all, there has to be an allegation of negligence in therapy. In this case, we're relying on the fact that it's an invalidated therapy. But in the second case, that allegation has to give rise to an accusation. Now, the amendment that I'm suggesting, I said in the brief, of felonious conduct. It doesn't have to be felonious conduct. To decide this case, the court could simply say an accusation of sexual abuse. But what's important, and goes to your question, is that accusation needs to get out of the therapy room. Okay, for if you were to go to your therapist and discuss deep, dark secrets, that has no impact on privilege or confidentiality. But the minute it moves out of the therapy room, whether it's calling Dr. and Mrs. Johnson into the room to say, by the way, you abused me, or filing restraining orders or telling family members there's a variety of ways this happens.
So anytime it's revealed, and that does not necessarily, if it's revealed in the living room after the session took place without the therapist being there, that would open it up anytime it's revealed.
Well, again, I appreciate that question. That's the third element that I've given, and I proposed that if it is revealed, and the Sawyer footnote says, we in Wisconsin are not going to require that it be made public. I agree with that footnote. Hungerford in New Hampshire did require it be made public. I think the standard should be made public or a confrontation. In other words, made public or made to the person, the alleged perpetrator.
How was it made public here, counsel?
Here it was made public in a variety of ways. One, the Johnsons were called into the therapy room. Two, there was a letter from a lawyer saying, and now we want money because you caused this. Three, there was within the hospital records where Dr. Johnson used to practice, there's an array of entries about her sexual abuse. And four, we are aware of other conversations that some are and some are not in the record.
Is that restraining order significant at all?
Sure. If I didn't mention that, most certainly the restraining order as well. I mean, that most certainly. So thank you. The fourth element that I was proposing, and this in part goes to Justice Bradley's dissent in Sawyer, is another possible element that could be added to decide this case is to say, as soon as the therapist plays a role. I mean, we're talking about a very specific type of therapy and a very specific type of confrontation that's outlined in the book Courage to Heal, that is basically the Bible for this kind of therapy.
Mr. Smaller.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Mr. Smaller, how do we know we're dealing with recovered memory therapy in this case?
How do we know that?
Yeah. Well, that's what we're dealing with.
Fair question. We may not know, okay? But I'm prepared to say that, and one of the most the premier psychologists in the country says, here are the indicia of it, confrontations, the idea of repression, the idea of hypnosis, all of those things are the kinds of things that are discussed in the popular press version of recovered memory therapy.
And if I can pin you down, you mentioned hypnosis. Yeah. I understand there's a dispute in the record as to whether or not hypnosis was used in this case?
Most certainly. Most certainly. And at this point, I can't determine that because I can't get the records. But that isn't, that's not the linchpin by itself. I mean, there's a, you know, half a dozen indicia. The principal issue being, is somebody going back and alleging that something long forgotten, or the term repressed, something long repressed is the cause of some discomfort for a patient, and then goes back to examine those events which lead, inevitably, to accusations of sexual abuse. That's the real core of what recovered memory therapy is. And it just happens, because of the book, The Courage to Heal, to have a whole lot of trappings that are common to all these cases. Nancy Sawyer changed her name to Nancy Anitra. Charlotte Johnson changed her name to Charlotte Dawn. I mean, you know, that what you're supposed to do when you realize these memories are real is all set forth in this kind of popular press literature.
I have a different question from the one that Justice Crooks asked. What is the most conservative theory on which you can prevail?
Thank you. I don't know that I got to say this. The most conservative theory would be that when there is an allegation of malpractice, when the accusation makes its way out of the therapy room and consists of an allegation of sexual abuse, okay, so those two things. An allegation of malpractice, negligence, that the therapy caused an accusation of sexual abuse, that allegation. Three, the accusation either becomes public or directed to the alleged perpetrator. And then four, if the therapist plays a role. And that gets back to Justice Crook's question. Justice Crooks, you said, you know, how do we compare this to the concerns about privilege? Or Justice Wilcox, same thing. If privilege was supposed to be sacred here, then these kinds of confrontations that are endorsed in this kind of therapy obviously goes against that. The therapists are actively involved in eliciting these claims and then participating in bolstering the patients to make the claims, exactly as the therapist did here, sitting next to Charlotte as she confronted both Dr. and Mrs. Johnson with.
If I may, I was up late last night, so maybe I missed this, but I don't quite see any dramatic difference between what you said to Justice Crooks and what you said to me. What I'm trying to get at is there any exception under the evidentiary privilege, or is there some other theory for someone who doesn't want to just create public policy here?
Yes. Okay. I provided that to the court, and I believe you could do it by extrapolating from either any of three things. One would be simply saying this is an extension of Parisoff/Schuster. Schuster says that when there is a potential for physical harm to a patient, the therapist has an obligation to come forward, but more importantly, in Schuster, the therapist is negligent if they don't, and obviously that negligence case only can be brought if the therapy records become available, so theoretically the therapy records become not privileged. I think that the kind of harm that this court recognized in Sawyer is no different than the kind of harm that was recognized in Schuster, and therefore should allow the same kind of exception. So you could do it by extrapolating from Schuster. A second way that you can do it is by extrapolating from 90504E, which says that there is no privilege related to claims of abused or neglected child. Now, I'm not saying that covers this situation, because it doesn't. Because the claims in these situations are Charlotte saying, as an adult, I'm now remembering I was an abused child. okay, so you could get there. And finally, under Chapter 48, where we know that if there is a report that the accused perpetrator has the opportunity ultimately to get that information. The other way to do it is simply under a 905.11 waiver argument. And that is, obviously you can waive, and this court need only say that when there is in a therapy circumstance, parents brought in, not to ask about history, etc., but for the purpose of telling them, we now know that you are sexually abused, and where the patient has a silent advocate and two therapists on their side, that in and of itself is a waiver. Now, you can also decide it based on the waiver facts of this case, and you understand that, but...
Does Charlotte need to be a party to this litigation in order to protect her rights or clearly articulate her position for the court?
I don't think she needs to be a party. I think she has participated and certainly should be given that right to participate. But Dr. and Mrs. Sawyer have no interest in suing their daughter. They see her as a victim. Okay, but she has articulated her position, which is she would not like her records open.
Does anyone believe that the plaintiffs are guilty of sexual abuse or child abuse?
I suspect Charlotte continues to. Dr. and Mrs. Johnson have had no contact with Charlotte, just like the Sawyers had no contact with Nancy. Once that allegation was made, they changed their names, they moved to other parts of the country. In Charlotte's mind and in Nancy Sawyer's mind, their parents are the devil, which is why this is such an awful experience. Dr. and Mrs. Johnson have two daughters who are physicians who have followed in his footsteps. They are upstanding, wonderful citizens who have been accused of the most grievous events possible.
Is there anyone other than Charlotte who believes that?
I suspect the therapists do. The therapists who went along with the recovered memory therapy certainly do, and I suspect that the survivor groups that Charlotte has gotten into, and I suspect that for a period of time, the family members that Charlotte would have talked to about I'm not having contact with my parents certainly have questions about it. Absolutely.
Counsel, Justice Prosser asked you for the most conservative way, and I interpreted that to mean what's the narrowest way you can get what you want. And you alluded to my dissent in Sawyer, and thus you know one of my concerns is, for want of a better phrase, where's the stopping point to the slippery slope? In both your response to Justice Crooks and to Justice Prosser, you say it has to consist of allegations of sexual abuse. Now, I've focused my question. And public policy is what this is all about. In weighing public policy, if you have a case where there's a sexual abuse that is of a lesser degree, and of course we have degrees in criminal law, but a lesser degree, and a touching that would, in a place where there could be sexual assault charges brought. If you contrast a lesser degree of sexual abuse versus beating up a kid, physical abuse, constant physical abuse, I mean, as I weigh things, and of course public policy is a matter of weighing, it seems to me that a protracted physical abuse, let's say, you know, and you can think of some horrible scenarios, you know, burning with cigarettes and tying the kids up and, you know, all these things that unfortunately as circuit court judges we see on occasion. So why should it be, what is the rational process by which you can limit it only to sexual abuse and not physical abuse?
The point is well taken. As you can see, I've grappled. I mean, I'm changing from the brief, and if you followed the briefs through the lower-level courts, you'd find some of the same grappling. I understand. I think we should make I understand why we may want to make it narrow. I think you're right. It isn't simply physical abuse. It's child abuse, period.
Because
Mrs. Johnson was not accused of sexual abuse. She was accused of physical abuse.
So what's the – if you say consists of allegations of sexual abuse, what's the principled rational distinction between, in your test, sexual abuse and why not include physical abuse?
Yeah, I apologize. Okay. I'm saying I wish to amend that.
Okay.
Remember, I started out with felonious acts and then thought, well, we could do this narrower. We could say child abuse. I said sexual abuse. I should have said physical or sexual abuse.
Okay, so if we're talking about consists of allegations of sexual or physical abuse, then what's to stop a third-party person who's accused of physically abusing a spouse? Because after all, you know, everyone here is an adult. You know, this isn't a Chapter 48 proceeding. This is an adult. So why doesn't a third-party spouse beater have the same rights in your test when the allegation is of malpractice, consists of allegations of physical or sexual abuse, becomes public? It seems to me that a third-party spouse abuser could have access to the same records.
And a fair question, and I think the answer is in the fourth element there. First of all, please understand, people don't bring malpractice cases easily. I'm sure this Court knows the kind of cost and commitment there are to these kinds of cases. But setting that aside, okay, it would meet the second element. It's made to the alleged abuser. It would meet, theoretically, the allegation of abuse, but the question is the therapist playing the role. And in here, in the Johnson case, as in the Sawyer case, the confrontations are with the therapists at their side, and you abused me. And I would submit to you that if a spouse says to another spouse, I now know you abused me, I know that, you know, and recovered this memory, and the therapists are standing there obviously endorsing that. Yep, ought to open there too. But that's all. That's pretty narrow.
Mr. Smollett, let me ask this. I think one of the concerns that I have, and Justice Bradley has alluded to this, is, you know, how far we open the door if we accept your position, accept your argument, where a person can just make an allegation and all of a sudden the privilege that a non-party has asserted is now trumped and no longer applies. What is your position if this Court were to follow along to an extent to that argument, to instead of employing a blanket waiver of privileges, which is what you're advocating, instead having an in-camera review by a trial court to determine whether or not we are dealing with recovered memory therapy. Because the concern is that if you follow your argument to a logical extreme, the allegation opens the door. And yet Charlotte Dawn has invoked her privilege here. So how do we protect her privilege, or how do we even analyze her privilege without someone else at least getting into the merits of the records?
First off, please, I want to underscore what I said to Justice Bradley, which I don't think malpractice cases are brought frivolously or spuriously. So I while I understand that there's this issue out there, I'd ask the Court to at least weigh its experience on how frequently this is likely really to happen. But in answer to your question, sorry, I lost it.
Whether or not to have the trial court do an in-camera review.
Thank you. I have no problem with that, with this exception, and that is, you understand that I would certainly agree with in-camera review to some extent, and there could be a gatekeeper function here. The problem is the extent to which I or another attorney might be able to educate a trial court, and the time that it may take to educate a trial court as to what are the words that are used to signal recovered memory therapy. It's not as easy as there are just these three words. For example, and I have a red light, but let me give you one quick example of that. Frequently in recovered memory therapy, the patients end up being diagnosed multiple personality disorder. This comes from Sybil, okay? Let's, you know, that's where it actually all goes back to. When these suits against therapists started to happen, suddenly there was a change in these kinds of records where the diagnosis of multiple personality disorder never showed up. Instead, it was post-traumatic stress disorder. Okay, but when you examine those therapists and say, what does that mean? What is, you know, you get to the same core facts. And so while I appreciate and would certainly welcome courts looking at it, it would have to require some education of a court to do that.
Thank you, Mrs. Smoley. You have several moments in rebuttal. Ms. McElroy?
Thank you. Please, the court. My name is Lori McElroy. I represent Rogers Memorial Hospital in this matter. And I have Sarah Zylstra with the Boardman firm. She represents Drs. Hollowell and Riesenauer and attorney David McFarlane with the Bell Gerhardt firm, who represents Dr. Kay Phillips. And we also have attorney Michael Russart with the fund, and he has a difficult job of not being allowed to speak here. So we have divided the issues as follows, and I am handling the waiver issue, which after listening to Attorney Smoller, I'm conscious that maybe the court will want to take some of my time and maybe ask questions of others. Attorney Zylstra is going to be handling the public policy arguments. Attorney McFarlane is going to be handling the argument about Dr. Kay Phillips and how she fits into the privilege, and he also is doing cleanup on both waiver and public policy questions or issues that he will follow up with.
Are all of these people psychologists? Hollowell, Riesenauer?
Drs. Riesenauer and Hollowell are psychologists. At the time, Kay Phillips, she was a social worker, I believe. She has recently...
No psychiatrists involved here.
No psychiatrists, no MDs. Correct. And Dr. Phillips' PhD is not in psychology. We were here before in 2001 when this court looked at this case and sent us back to do a factual development, and I wanted to just highlight some of the key points in the factual development that brought us back here today. Charlotte Dawn is the daughter of Dr. and Mrs. Johnson, and as Justice Butler asked, she is not a party to this case, and she has indicated no desire to be a party to this case. She was deposed, and the entirety of her deposition is in the record in docket number 93. She affirmatively started her deposition saying that she first had a flashback of abuse while an adult and prior to meeting any of the defendants in this case. She expressed frustration throughout that deposition at being pursued by her parents and expressed the fear that all her friends were going to be continually harassed in this matter. She submitted an affidavit in this case that directed the health care providers to guard her privilege. That's in record docket number 50. Her amicus brief that she filed in this matter sums up her position. She wanted to protect her records and not make them potential evidence. Those records, she claimed, had intimate and painful details of a former life. She thinks the access to those records in this case, in her words, would make her the loser here, and that the court would allow her parents to circumvent her clear wishes to be free of contact with them and free of further involvement in this lawsuit. That was her amicus brief. I am dealing with the privilege and the potential waiver thereof found in Section 905.04. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Jaffe matter recognized that effective psychotherapy depends on the atmosphere of confidence and trust, and that was something that was recognized in Justice Wilcox's concurring opinion in the Sawyer case. The Steinberg versus Jensen case discusses the privilege here. The privilege is statutory. The plaintiff, the patient, not the plaintiff, but the patient is the one who can prevent disclosure. Public policy recognizing a privilege encourages free and candid discussions to be protected. And the patient, and only the patient, is the one who can waive. And that was something that came up in the Sampson case that was discussed.
Well, was it waived when they brought the parents in and had a big discussion with the therapist?
I think, and that was one of the arguments here, that I think is considered within Section 905.04, sub 1, sub B, when they talk about what is confidential information. A communication is still confidential. If it is part of diagnosis and treatment, it's participation under the direction of a psychologist, and it includes members of the family. Section 905.11, which is the waiver statute, which allows waiver of the privilege when you have a voluntary disclosure of a significant part of the matter or communication. The last sentence, however, of that statute indicates this section does not apply. There is no waiver if the disclosure is itself a privileged communication, and would appear from Section 905.04, sub 1, sub B, that bringing the parents in for the confrontation was a part of the therapy and itself was part of the privileged communication.
What about the restraining order?
The restraining order was brought in the court. There is no law in Wisconsin that would allow a prior action to act as a waiver in a subsequent action. To allow in every restraining order where there is abuse to have the person who's been abused to produce their medical records, their psychological records, I don't think is an action that this court would want to allow. And in fact, in that action, the parents did not attempt to get any of her medical records at that time, and I think it would be speculation from us how many years later, from 1992, to say that Charlotte wouldn't have had a choice to make at that time. If her parents were going to seek her records, she may have had the ability to review that and say, look, if I have to turn over my records in this kind of situation, I'm going to drop the restraining order. That same very thing happened with the letters written by her attorney. She subsequently did not bring an action against her parents. There is nothing in the statute that allows for that kind of waiver short of bringing an action. She never put her medical records at issue.
Ms. McElroy, what about the analogy to the exceptions in the statute already, in both statutes, 905.04 and 146.82, that talk about allegations concerning sexual or physical abuse of a child? Isn't there a very good argument that given the fact that we've already recognized or the legislature has recognized such exceptions, that it's really a small extension to apply such exceptions to this particular case?
Well, I think it's actually a larger extension that when you are dealing with an adult. In this situation, Ms. Dawn was an adult when this happened. The statutes are created to protect children who cannot speak for themselves.
Well, aren't the allegations that this occurred when she was a small child?
But by the time she claims that she remembered these, she was an adult and was able to take care of herself. There was nothing that the state could come in and do. In those situations where there is a waiver, it's so that the county can come in and protect the child. At this point, we're well beyond that, and the statute of limitations had run.
Could I ask you, what do you think these parents should have done? Should just take it?
I don't know. We don't know all the situation of all the communications between the daughter and the parents during that time frame. The actual confrontation itself has not been delved into factually. Whether the parents should just take it, it's not something where I can say what they would or should have done. But Charlotte Dawn has made it very clear that she wanted to work through this on her own and that she wanted to protect her records. If I may...
Well, I don't quite understand how someone can make accusations publicly of sexual abuse by someone else and then expect not to be held accountable for those statements in any way.
And that was an action between Charlotte Dawn and her parents and Charlotte Dawn. That is not something where we have the evidence here in this matter against a negligent claim against the psychologist or the hospital.
So you're saying that the psychologist and hospital didn't reveal this alleged sexual abuse?
Charlotte Dawn herself in her deposition said she had her very first flashback prior to even meeting any of the defendants.
I know, but is there anything in this record that the therapists or the hospital revealed the allegations of sexual abuse other than to the parents?
No, there is no allegation anywhere. There is no fact anywhere that any of the defendants published this information other than that confrontation, which we've already discussed.
Let me just ask you this. What good is the Sawyer cause of action if you have patient privilege? You only have a Sawyer cause of action then if the patient is deceased, because then there's no privilege.
And that's a very concern that was addressed in the Sawyer matter, saying that this may be a totally different case in the event that the parents don't have access to that. And I believe that Attorney Zylstra is going to cover that a little more thoroughly. I didn't cover all my arguments, but if you have any other questions, I see I have a red light.
Are there any situations in which the psychologists, the people treating someone like Charlotte, would be required to report that information?
Those, I don't believe so. And those records of psychologist requirements is not before. She was an adult when she met with them.
Suppose she had been, say, 16 or 17.
Well, I think we get back to the earlier question when you are dealing with statutes that we require when they're a minor, someone needs to step in and look out for them. Okay.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Zylstra.
May it please the court, my name is Sarah Zylstra. I've been given the task of talking about the public policy implications of the plaintiff's exception to privilege. That in and of itself is challenging. Asking me to do it in 10 minutes might be insurmountable, but I'm here to give it my best shot. I'm going to go right to the heart of this and lay out for the court exactly what my position is. My position is this. As long as the patient is alive and is asserting her privilege, there is no cause of action. That's exactly right, Justice Abrams-Hampson, because there can't be. Why? That's the $10,000 question, right? First, I believe Mr. Smoller concedes his point that the therapist can't defend themselves if the privilege is intact. What Mr. Smoller's obligation will be is to prove that we violated the standard of care. In order for us to defend ourselves, the therapist will have to show that they exercise the same standard of care as the average practitioner when faced with these facts in this patient. They can't do that without talking about what the patient was communicating with them, et cetera. So, and I don't think there's any dispute on that point.
Let me ask, what about the right of the parents to defend themselves against such accusations? Should they be shut off from any type of remedy if there has indeed been neglectful behavior by the therapist?
Well, and I'm going to answer that question in two different ways. First of all, and I think where this is going is that the argument here about in violating the privilege here is that negligent behavior will go unchecked. Unlikely. Very unlikely. Why? First of all, as everyone concedes, some of these patients are able to bring these claims themselves. Sometimes they retract their statements. that happens. Sometimes the patients, at some point, these patients do die, and their parents become administrators of their estate, and they bring those causes of action on behalf of themselves and the estate. Third, so, and the therapists in those cases, they don't know which patients are going to retract, which patients are going to die, et cetera. So the fact that a patient could bring this claim at some point keeps them honest with respect to their therapy. The third thing is that patients like Charlotte are not living in isolation. It's not that the only person they're seeing is this therapist. They have friends. They have other people that are around them. They have siblings, all of which are likely engaging this person in discussion about themselves, their mental health, their therapy. Oftentimes, these patients ultimately see other therapists.
Ms. Zylstrom, let me ask this. Assume for sake of argument, Mr. Smoller's position that there has been bad therapy here and that that bad therapy led to false recollections, false memories of what occurred with her parents and herself. How is it good public policy to allow or to preclude anyone from getting beyond the privilege in order to protect Ms. Dawn, Charlotte? In other words, she may be, as a result of the therapy, victimized to the point where she's just bought into it, but if it's a false recollection, how do you go about protecting not just the Johnsons, but protecting her?
First of all, there's no evidence of any transference, which is a term that the court's familiar with from other cases. Second of all...
But how would we know that?
Well, Your Honor...
It's privilege.
Well, Your Honor, sometimes there is evidence of transference. Charlotte could have been communicating with other people regarding what's going on in her therapy. Oftentimes, transference is related to a sexual relationship with a therapist. That in of itself often becomes known to others. But at this point, the court is faced with this record, and there's no evidence of that, for one. Two, it's extremely, extremely paternalistic for us to say that because someone has a mental health problem, that they don't have the ability to decide whether their therapy is beneficial or not. This court has talked about many times about mental health being a stigma. It is a stigma. And I think when we suggest that a person with a mental health condition doesn't have the ability to evaluate their own therapy, we make the stigma worse. And I would suggest the court not to do that. Third thing I think you're really asking is, and what you're really saying is, you're asking the question that I was answering, which is, we don't want negligent conduct to go unchecked. And I'm trying to answer that it doesn't go unchecked. There are lots of places where this type of conduct will be kept in check, including when people see other therapists. Therapists will often talk to a patient and be evaluating whether the therapy that a patient has gotten previously is helpful.
Let me ask, if I may, the same question I asked of Mr. Smoller. What would your position be regarding having, in a situation where you have these allegations and you have the asserted privilege, allowing a trial court to do an in-camera review to determine whether or not the allegations that were made have any basis at all that would require looking beyond the privilege?
Absolutely not, and for several reasons. The first reason is that this... disclosing the records to the trial court is an invasion of Charlotte's privilege, and she does not want that done. So first, right off the bat, we're disregarding the privilege, and I'm absolutely against that position. The second thing is, this isn't like the attorney-client privilege. Oftentimes, trial courts do in-camera inspections to determine whether something is protected by the attorney-client privilege. In this case, the trial court wouldn't be looking at the records to see whether or not the privilege applied. Everybody agrees the privilege applies here to the records.
I'm thinking more of the Pennsylvania versus Ritchie type privilege situation.
That is a perfect leadway into a point that I think is fundamental here. And it has to comes out of Shifra, a case where a female had made sexual assault charges against the defendant. The defendant, in trying to defend himself against those criminal charges, wanted the patient's records because they believed that the patient was unable to determine truth or veracity based on her mental health, correct? Trial court did an in-camera inspection and made the initial
check on materiality, whether there was the material things in the record that would warrant turning over exculpatory evidence for the defendant. What happened in that case? What's the result? The result is the trial court says you have to turn over the records. But does the defendant get the records under SHFRA? Nope. Why not? Because the patient still has the right to waive the privilege. They decide. The patient's privilege is the patient's privilege. The patient has the option then, turn over the records or walk away. We're not going to let you testify in court. I tell you what, if Charlotte were here today, she'd say, I'll take that choice. I'm taking my records. I'm walking out. I won't testify in court. She doesn't want to testify in court. We do an in-camera inspection. Trial court turns over the records. What happens? Follow through with this scenario. This is akin to defamation. That's really what they're claiming. They were accused of a heinous crime that they didn't commit, right? I, as an attorney for the therapist, what's the most used defense to defamation? Truth. The allegations are true. There's no defamation claim, right? I, as a therapist, will have the responsibility, and it will not be a pleasant one, of trying to prove the truth of the allegations. I will be required to subpoena and call Charlotte to the stand in front of a jury and demand that she go through the heinous crimes that she disclosed to her psychologist. How fair is that? I, as a patient, not only am I violated the first time by the trial court looking at my records, not only is my privilege violated again because my parents get the records, but I get violated a third time by having to sit in a courtroom and tell the jury about all the things that I didn't want anybody to know in the first place. And we all know that oftentimes these salacious cases draw in reporters. There's a high likelihood that ends up in the paper. I don't think Charlotte could move far enough away to get over that.
Isn't the problem here one of false memory, one of using the phrase that opposing counsel, recovered memory therapy? Now, I'm just intrigued by this in-camera inspection. But here we had your clients or the statement that she remembered this before she went to the therapist. But if it was narrowed down to simply the question whether this so-called therapy was used, and that was a simple question before the judge. In other words, I'm just trying to play off of the questions by Justice Butler and others that perhaps we could have an in-camera inspection that would just allow for that, not the salacious details, but whether or not that was used.
The problem comes in Mr. Smoller's response to that question, which is, but I want the chance to educate the judge on what he or she should be looking for. Judges do not have the ability to understand and to determine, looking at mental health records, what these things mean, what kind of therapies were done, what is the significance of things that may be appearing in the record. Judges are going to need to be educated in some fashion. And that, I think, therein lies the problem. With attorney-client privilege, the judge is simply looking at the document saying, is it privileged, is it not? That is something that I think a trial court can do well. But what we'd be asking the judge is looking at all of these mental health records, and Lord knows they may be deep, evaluate that information and tell me, judge, whether there's stuff in there that could help me sue these docs for a cause of action. We're asking the judge to really look at the merits of the case, and I think that is incredibly difficult.
You say this is akin to defamation. Isn't this a suit for negligent infliction of emotional distress?
Well, Your Honor, and I have a red light, but I would like to address that question because I think that in Sawyer, I think there are two parts of the Sawyer claim, and I think it's difficult to determine which way you go. On the one hand, really what the Johnsons are complaining, if someone walked up to you on the street, someone you didn't know, and said, I think you're a child molester, is that going to hurt me?
No, I'm probably going to look at the person and say, well, you're crazy. I'm going to walk across the street and keep walking. It's the fact that it came from the daughter that makes it such a difficult accusation to handle. And I think it's the Mr. Smoller's point along this line has been the accusation is so heinous because it is child sexual assault. I think that's really, in some respects, a defamation claim. The other part of the Sawyer claim is the negligent infliction of emotional distress. That, to me, gets us into Bowen. If it is an NIED claim, that claim is, in some respects, must satisfy the requirements of Bowen, and I'm not sure this claim does. But I do think that the defamation analysis is applicable, although it's not a claim for defamation. Sawyer has established a separate claim. Certainly what comes under defamation is relevant to defending
it
against such a claim.
It didn't treat this as a Bowen claim, did it?
Excuse me?
Sawyer did not treat this as a Bowen claim.
No, it did not.
It treated it as just a negligent infliction of emotional distress, saying that the therapist was negligent in handling the patient, and that below the standard of care, and that the result was that it resulted in harm, emotional distress to a third party, which was within the foreseeable foreseeability.
That was causal. That was part of Bowen as well. Bowen did that analysis, and then continued with
that. Sawyer did not.
No, Sawyer did not. I believe Justice Bradley's dissent in Sawyer did raise that, imply the question of whether or not. And I know I'm out of time. I just want two sentences, and that is.
Make them short.
I shall. I'm going to quote you, Justice Abrahamson.
And make them long.
This is from Samson, just last term. A privilege must be predictable to have its intended effect. An uncertain privilege is a privilege that is little better than no privilege at all. I concur.
Mr. McFarland, representing Dr. Kay Phillips.
Thank you. Good morning, and counsel in the court. My name is David McFarland. I represent Kay Phillips, and Kay Phillips is in court this morning as well. Dr. Phillips has a Ph.D. in counseling and guidance, and she has practiced as a psychotherapist since 1988. She has always practiced in clinics providing private psychotherapy. They have been clinics that have been certified as Chapter 51 outpatient mental health treatment facilities throughout her career. She has been under the supervision of a psychologist or a psychiatrist in the critical time period here. It was Dr. David Israelstam. Dr. Israelstam met with Dr. Phillips and others in the clinic. There may have been three or four other therapists.
Dr. Israel was a psychiatrist?
He was a psychiatrist, yes, Your Honor.
And is she, Dr. Phillips, an employee of Dr. Israel?
No. Dr. Israelstam was a contract psychiatrist for Heartland Counseling. And he would review all cases, and he would discuss the diagnosis. His testimony, while there clearly is some, the plaintiff tries to make some issue about the extent of Dr. Israelstam's involvement. His deposition identifies that he would meet with these counselors and talk over at least once a month. He would meet with Dr. Phillips and up to four other therapists. This is all in Record 89, Exhibit B. He would discuss new cases, symptoms, and diagnosis. If he agreed, he signed off on the diagnosis and attested that the case had been reviewed with him. He discussed each case at the time of intake, and then every 30 or 90 days after that, depending on the frequency of the therapy, and that the time spent on individual cases could be as little as 1 minute, but it could be as much as 45 minutes. So there is lots of supervision. She was in these certified mental health outpatient treatment facilities. And her degree, Your Honor, is the same degree that in 1995 allowed her, qualified her rather, to be certified as a professional counselor. That was a certification that first came in place in 1995. Dr. Phillips, as soon as that was available, applied and has become certified under that standard. That position was the same throughout. You know, the professional importance of her licensure, her education, has always been the same. Charlotte Dawn, before...
Was it required under any law or practice that she be supervised by Dr. Israelton?
Pardon?
Was it required in any way that she be supervised in this way by the Dr. Israelton?
To be certified under Chapter 51 as an outpatient health mental health care providing clinic, yes, it was.
So she needed the supervision in order to practice?
Yes, she did.
Okay.
Yes, she did. There are, this case, and I hope that deals with the issues of the confidentiality and privilege as to Dr. Phillips.
I'd like to, if you're going to move on, stop you right there.
Please.
As you know, there's a case called State versus Locke.
Yes.
And among other things, State versus Locke looks at the expectation of the patient. Is there anything in this record that would indicate that Charlotte had an expectation that when she talked to Dr. Phillips that that was confidential in terms of communication?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's in the record?
There are several things in the record. In her deposition, Charlotte reported that she was referred to Dr. Phillips by another professional. She did not identify who this other professional was, but it was clear that it was some kind of mental health treater who referred Charlotte to Dr. Phillips and the Heartland Counseling Group. There is one of the medical records that the plaintiffs did obtain from St. Mary's Hospital. It was a February 1992 admission note. This is appellant's appendix, page 29. And there it says, Charlotte is very guarded about her information, does not want it shared with her parents or sisters at this time. She then signed a very limited authorization, February 7th. There is a very limited authorization signed by Charlotte that had a box on it for whether she was going to allow access to psychiatric records. She did not check that box. She checked another section of the authorization that said she was providing access for limited records only. And those limited records were specifically identified her by her. This is appellant's appendix, page 28, as follows. Medical, and then in parentheses, physical, test results, medications prescribed, general progress. She had the opportunity to check the box for records relating to treatment for psychiatric conditions, and she chose not to. We have more. In April of 1992, Dr. Johnson, went to Dr. Phillips' office to confront his daughter and to confront the therapist, and in his words, to find out what is going on. The police were called, and the police escorted Dr. Phillips out of that office. Charlotte wanted nothing to do with her father going and talking to her and her therapist. She went so far as to call the police and have the police escort him away. Mr. Johnson's affidavit, appellant's appendix 26, confirms that he attempted to contact Kay Phillips to find out information about that, about his daughter, and that shortly after those attempts, he received the restraining order petition. In the restraining order petition of June 18th of 92, Charlotte states that she needs a restraint because of my parents' constant attempts at coercing me to follow their suggestions for treatment. I think there is plenty of evidence in the record that Charlotte considered all of her comments and her communication with Dr. Phillips to be confidential. She has asserted that back in 1991, in 1992, and in this lawsuit. You know, there is no ending point to this kind of lawsuit. look at what the plaintiffs have done. They filed a lawsuit alleging below professional standard of care when they don't have a clue about what went on. I know of no case of professional negligence against a doctor, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a therapist, where they don't have the medical records, and they don't know what went on. Yet they believe that the mere allegation, having no knowledge of what went on, the mere allegation of negligence, is that enough? We do have a frivolous claim statute that I think requires that you have a good faith basis before you make that allegation. And there have been cases that say, if you don't have the records and don't obtain an expert's review, how can you make that allegation? In good faith. Because an allegation of professional negligence requires proof by a professional who says, I know what went on, and it is below the professional standard of care. They don't have that.
Mr. McFarland, I'm inferring from your argument that the healthcare professionals actually believe what Charlotte is saying.
That's not necessary, Your Honor. They're dealing with a severely troubled person. Individuals who go into therapy. Charlotte Dawn was depressed. She had an eating disorder. She was an alcoholic. She screamed out in an outrageous manner in her office before going to any therapy. She was in desperate straits. You know, child abuse happens, and people go into therapy when they are the most vulnerable and the most fragile. And the job of a therapist is not to be an investigator. It's not to be an advocate for the parents. It's not to challenge what the patient brings forward. It's to help them survive. This is an attempt. You have an adult, a competent adult, who has chosen her therapists and believes she is getting better. You have parents, and her therapists tell her that this kind of confrontation session is necessary to help you, or it was clearly part of her therapy. So this all came out as part of the professional judgments. If this court allows this kind of claim to go forward, no therapist would undertake any kind of discussion with a patient about confronting the perpetrator. Because if you do, if you confront the perpetrator, all of your treatment records are suddenly available. And that there is no stopping point. What about a spouse who is accused by, or whose wife says to her therapist, my spouse is sexually and physically abusing me. And the spouse goes to her husband, with or without the therapist present, but at the therapist's encouragement, and says, you know, George, I've come to realize that you've been physically and sexually and emotionally abusing me. And what I thought, and our sexual relations have amounted to rape. Does that open up all of her records? Does an adult who goes to a priest and says, I realize now that when I was a young child, you molested me. I'm not going to sue you. I'm not going to pursue any claim against the church. I need to get better. And my therapist tells me that this is going to help me get better. Well, I'm not going to sue you, and I'm not going to do anything more with this. Does that open up all of those persons' records? That's what this claim would amount to. I have the red light, too.
Well, in this case, there was litigation, and there were demands for, $600,000 plus $4,000 per month for 10 years?
Those were letters by an attorney. No lawsuit was ever filed. If a lawsuit like that was ever filed, it absolutely would open up her records. There is no doubt about that. She had that choice. She chose not to file a lawsuit. It is the parents here who are trying to, in an unprecedented manner, break through the privilege and turn the therapist into their advocate or into a person who's going to tell this patient who is fragile and has never been in a safe place in her life to say, if you tell me these things, I have to tell your parents. And if you tell me these things, I have to turn all your records over. What is that going to do to therapy? And what is that going to do? You know, the Jaffe case, and this court over and over has recognized that the psychiatrist mental health treatment situation is so much more fragile than the medical privilege for medical doctors or the lawyer-client privilege because of the fragile emotional state of these individuals. The Jaffe case is very eloquent in that. Justice Wilcox, I think, referred to this in his concurring opinion in the Sawyer case. There's eloquent language out there about the importance of this. And an in-camera review doesn't solve that problem because judges cannot determine whether treatment by a therapist falls below a professional standard of care. Are you going to suggest that the trial judges in this court are supposed to undertake that burden? Or are you going to suggest that if there are, from Mr. Smoller's words, point of view, magic words in this record, suddenly that opens the whole thing to discovery? There is no stopping point here. This would be incredibly devastating to the therapeutic relationship if this was to go forward.
Thank you, Mr. McFarland. Mr. Smoller?
Let me first respond to the very last statement. There's nothing that would be devastating about a rule that simply says that confidentiality is breached if A, or privilege is breached if A and B happen. It's no different than Tarasoff and Sawyer. It simply means the therapists then have to say to their patients, as they do now, if A and B happens, you will no longer be privileged. So this chamber of horrors, it just simply isn't out there. I'd like to respond to some of the factual things that were...
So your answer is that is the stopping point, so they have to disclose. In other words, when you say A and B, just give me an example.
I'm sorry.
Well, the argument made by your opposing counsel is there isn't any stopping point to what you're requesting. And you said, yes, there is, because the patient can go in and tell the therapist... Or the therapist to say, well, if you tell me A or B, then I'm going to have to reveal that. What? Tell me what you're talking about. What's the stopping point?
Okay. It's you can tell me anything. If what we talk about here leads to a confrontation or in any other way a public disclosure of your beliefs of sexual abuse by your parents, then these records get opened up. So you can guarantee it doesn't happen, just like you can guarantee in Tarasoff, if you don't tell me you're going to go out and shoot somebody, nothing becomes non-privileged. But if you do take these actions, it does become non-privileged. The couple of factual things I want to deal with. First of all, the statement that Charlotte had a memory before she ever engaged in therapy. The court should note whether it's important. The memory was not a sexual abuse memory. It was some feeling, some jitteriness and whatever. And then what happens is she goes to a therapist with an agenda, is what I would say. And that funny feeling and feeling like there's an image back there suddenly becomes an image of sexual abuse. The court might also note that in Sawyer, Nancy Sawyer went to a therapist and had some memories of sexual abuse before she went to the defendant therapist in that case. That didn't stop the jury from awarding $1.6 million to the parents because those therapists failed to do what's required of them, which is to sit back and evaluate, are we going in a bad direction here? Are we ending up helping this patient or are we hurting this patient? And when the therapist chooses to continue in a direction that's hurting the patient and then hurting third parties, that therapist has to account for that in court. So the timing here is not so critical. The court might also note that, again, this was popular press stuff. People could read The Courage to Heal or some of the first-party disclosure books and easily start having these feelings. That what happens is a therapist has to bring the science to it to say, wait a second, don't go there, or do go there, depending on what information is gathered.
Mr. Smoller,
yes.
You just mentioned the $1.6 million. Is this a charge of medical malpractice?
Yes.
Is this under Chapter 655?
Well, that would depend on your interpretation of the Sawyer decision. Okay, the Sawyer decision allowed for this claim to go ahead and indicated that 650, or actually it may have been the earlier Johnson decision as well, that there are some claims that malpractice that can be brought without regard to the language in 655. Now, whether that means 655 is expanded or this is outside of 655,
except for one person, you don't have a physician.
Yes, that's thank you.
55 right. Talks about physician or nurse anesthetist.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
And no, that's why right. None of these people except Dr. Israelton, who's not a defendant, if I got it right.
Correct. He is not.
Everybody is a PhD psychologist, and I don't see that that's covered under 655.
Right.
Unless,
right.
And the hospital itself is not covered under 655.
The hospital may be covered under 655.
That's the only one?
I believe so.
But, you know,
and just so the court knows, again, Kay Phillips is not a psychologist. She's got an education.
But she's got a PhD. Right. She's not a
right.
physician.
The fund is involved here, though, isn't it?
Only as it stands behind Rogers.
Behind the hospital.
Right, Rogers Memorial Hospital.
Under okay. what in 655 does the hospital get involved?
I'm sorry?
Under what provisions of 655... They were directly involved, weren't they, the
yes.
hospital?
Yes,
okay.
yes,
okay.
exactly. Well, actually, they were involved, but we also brought them in under ostensible agency theory because they were advertising for this kind of therapy administered by the defendants here. The question about whether or not Charlotte wanted her records released, I believe Mr. McFarland discussed some, as did Ms. McElroy. We really don't have anything in the record that says anything about whether she was willing to release her records earlier. She certainly doesn't. She now says do not release them. But I'm not as clear as defense counsel here that this was her statement then. We know when she went into the hospital that she was suicidal and said don't give out my records here, and then 4 days later signs an authorization. And I invite you to look at that authorization. You're going to see it's a pre-printed form by the hospital. She marks something. It's a psychiatric admission. She's letting go of her records for that psychiatric admission. I have some other comments, but my red light is on, and unless the court allows, I will end.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Smoller and Mr. McFarland and Ms. McElroy and Ms. Silstra. For your argument in Johnson versus Rogers Memorial Hospital. Thank you. And the court is in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third case today.